proceeds from the Father and the Son.
Yes.
Orthodox, it's from the Father.
Yes.
And we say the Son.
Yes.
Father and the Son.
Father and the Son. Yes.
Well,
it was one of the factors. I think there was a big cultural divide between the basically the east side of the Mediterranean that was Greek-speaking and the west side of the Mediterranean that was Latin-speaking, and different customs had grown up. For example, the Western church tended to use unleavened bread in communion, and the Eastern churches used leavened bread, bread that would rise, right? And what else? In the Western church, the custom was growing up that priests had to be celibate. They had to make a commitment to be single. In the Eastern church, the custom is priests cannot get married, but a married person can become a priest. So if you're, there are plenty of married priests in Eastern Orthodox churches. It's just the way the customs developed in their churches. It's an interesting thing I tell my students. Yes, yeah. Yes, there are. In fact, we have one in Dallas who's a friend of mine. He's
an Episcopal priest or a Lutheran, and
you can become Catholic, and yeah. So at St. Rita's in Dallas, which is a Jesuit church, I mean, you may know the culture of Jesuit, they're always kind of on the progressive edge of things. But sure enough, they've got a former Episcopal priest who's brought his whole family with him, and Father such and such, and his wife. And that's a different thing for Catholics. But back to your question, historically, the old form of the creed was say that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. It was again in Charlemagne's time that they added from the Father and the Son, because they had a heresy that questioned whether Jesus was really truly God at that time. We had had another heresy like that earlier. Well, it was Arianism early on, and then it's called adoptionism in this time. And so they want to sort of, it's really a way of bolstering the divinity of the Son to say the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. But the newer Catechism of the Catholic Church, which is this really big volume that came out in the 1990s, it makes it very clear that both forms of the creed are valid, and that Catholics are comfortable with having communion with Christians who say it in a different way. So
I want to throw something at you.
Okay.
So we do need to train people, and in prayer especially.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
And I think it is just so important.
It is.
Some people will say, well, yeah, don't ask me to pray in public because you're not giving me something to read. Well,
yeah.
Stand up there and pray. Well, they can't, you know,
they're
not comfortable with that. So,
yeah.
Just kind of push on that a little bit, because I think it's really important.
It is.
For people to be able to do yes and.
Yeah. Yeah, in the apps that I use, there is a point where it says here you can add your own supplications and prayers, and typically, you know, when you do these prayers in a community, at some point, whether it's before or after or at a point during the prayers, you do take the prayers of the community so people can simply indicate the concerns that they have. Now, whether you make up sentences, see, one of the problems, I mean, I'll just to further the dialogue, one of the problems is when you have a community that's used to people making up prayers, it becomes very formulaic very fast. So we refer to what we call Jesus We Just prayers. You know what I mean? Jesus, we just really pray that you would just really, they don't think of that as a liturgy, but that's exactly how liturgies arise, is that you just hear someone else praying and you say it like that. But that's one of the things you do. You listen to other people praying and then you learn how to say it. The other thing, though, is I have taught my students when I teach spiritual formation, you can pray without words. So, for example, if you're concerned about a particular person, one way to do this is to kind of think about Jesus. Just imagine Jesus as concretely as you can. And then think about this person. You imagine them and their concern as concretely as you can. And then you kind of merge those images together. And whatever happens, that's your prayer, right? Well, whatever happens when Jesus meets that concern, that individual, that merged image is what you pray. You don't have to say, I pray that this would happen or that would happen. It's just the prayer is the image. And some people are more image-oriented than word-oriented. So you have to learn your own
way. How about that Acts way. Format? Adoration, confession, thanksgiving, and then supplication. You really come to God first knowing that, you know, God is there. And
yeah.
Thanking Him for then all the things and confessing your sin and thanking Him for His forgiveness.
I think those are the four things that have to happen. Adoration, confession, thanksgiving, supplication. Yeah. Now, in the app that I use, it goes C-T-A-S, which doesn't make the acrostic, you know, that you can remember as well. It starts with confession, thanksgiving, adoration, and then, no, actually, it goes C-A-T-S, cats. That's fine. We can go with cats. Cats are divine beings. Confession, adoration, thanksgiving, and then supplication. But I would say, however order you do it, those are the four things that need to happen. Except I got in trouble one time. Well, I didn't get in trouble, but the first time I ever preached in Spanish, I was preaching a sermon on prayer, and it followed that A-C-T-S pattern. And I was going to say, isn't it cool? But then I realized that in Spanish, the word for thanksgiving is acción de gracias. It's not. It doesn't start with a T. I mean, adoración, you're fine. Confesión, that's fine. But it's acas instead of suplicación is fine. But the thanksgiving, acción de gracias, is a little different than we did it. So I had to eventually teach them acas rather than acts. So, but yeah, that's fine. I think those are the four things that typically happen in daily prayer. Gosh, my mama taught me to kneel by my bed and say, now Dale and I got different forms of the child's prayer. She got the liberal form and I got the conservative shocking. Yes, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, thy child to keep. Now that's the liberal version. Thy love guard me through the night and wake me with the morning light. Isn't that sweet? But mine was, if I die before I wake, I pray thee, Lord, my soul to take.
How about there are four corners on my bed, Matthew, Mark, and John?
Yes. Yes, there you are. Yeah, I think. That's terrific. That's the Catholic version of it, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was not Catholic. That's like, you know, the informal prayers over meals that are good food, good meat, good Lord, let's eat. Or rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub.
One of the ways we do teach our little children.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the horrors of growing up in an evangelically oriented church as I did, and it was Methodist, but great emphasis on personal prayer that you make, is that we'd have prayer circles, and then you'd go around the circle, and the competition was everyone was longer than the next one. And you start, you know, if you're mathematically minded, you start calculating, it's going to be next year before you get out of here, you know, so spare me. Good. And also, we sometimes practice, what's the fancy word for it? In gastro benediction. That means when you say the prayer after you've actually after you started eating. Yeah, bless the food with us. Yes, there you are. Yes. Yeah, so what do you do?
And all that is within me.
Yes, right. I got to remember that one now. That's really good.
I come from a very different tradition in that, but not a lot of formula involved. But it was more of a conversation. I even remember as a 3-year-old just talking to God. I didn't feel like I didn't call it prayer, but I was just talking to him at different times throughout the day. But the other part of that was the listening part. That it's not just all about me talking to him, but just being present.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a hard concept, I think, for even adults to wrap around sometimes. But to me, that's an intimate conversation and one that I feel more comfortable that way than I do.
This is one of the things that the mystical teachers say, though, is that the analogy they use is that if you've been away from someone for a while, you first chit-chat, filling each other in on everything that's going to be happening, and then you just want to be together. You just want to sit there together and be close, and that their idea of a kind of mystical union is that point where you are just with God, and it doesn't have to involve words, it doesn't have to involve even images at that point. It can just be your resting in God.
Intentional in that you've taken this time to be present. It's not just an afterthought, but you set aside that time to do that, which is a little different than just thinking about it on the fly or fitting it in. But to be intentional and purposeful makes it sacred.
To devote time to that, yes, right. And you know, when I take students to Epworth and to London, where his house was, you can pray in his closet. I mean, there is a little prayer area off to the side, and it has his prie-dieu, his kneeler there, and you can spend your own little time in there.
I pray in my car a lot.
I do too. That's
the It's a good reason to pray in a car. I mean,
especially on 94.
Yeah.
So this time when she came, we had to rush out, and she had to go back. She said, I have to pray. God always answers, has a significant difference in my prayers in when I pray in the ORU prayer garden. I think a lot of that is emotional. It's not just...
I understand that in front of the hospital there at ORU built...
It used to be in front of the hospital, but it doesn't belong to ORU anymore. So
I know. But it has the two praying hands, but it's Oral's hands, I think they said that it was modeled on.
Well,
They're big. They're really big hands, I tell you. I've seen them.
They're big. And my ex-sister-in-law had told me something else about that. I don't remember. I just remember it was a big to-do with it. It's still very, very...
I think you bring up something interesting about the place. When I come to Edward for the first time of the year, and I just sit here and look, at this lake, the sacredness of these grands, and all the people who've gone before, that just becomes an open prayer for me all the time.
And for everybody, it's something different.
So, I mean, you obviously have got the old Vesper point here, and that I take it that concrete is older than these buildings here, right? That's been there for a while. But where did I hear yesterday that sometimes they would pray at Mount Epworth in the morning? Because I guess there you've got a view, not now, but maybe there was a view out toward the east.
How they didn't burn the place down, I don't know. But it was always at night for prayers to be read by those torchlight.
There weren't as many trees down
there. Maybe that's right.
That's why I was reading in Steps to the Heights this morning. I thought I was going to find that reference to praying up there, but I didn't find it while I was reading this morning. So do you follow the Daily Office Lectionary for that?
So different people have started different things this summer. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, cool. Because, I mean, the lectionary means the table of readings. And there's a Sunday lectionary, which is like a three-year cycle. But there's a Daily Office Lectionary that's typically a two-year cycle. But it's keyed to the season, the Christian season of the year. So there's a kind of thematic going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they should have the same Anglicans and Episcopalians.
If I could put a plug in, does everybody get the daily readings from Richard Rohr? I find those a very interesting thing to read as a Catholic.
Yes.
And it gives me a lot of prayer points to go off from things that he writes. I find it very interesting. I find so many people, because I deal with people, they're all reading that. So that's their common, that's where the questions come from. I can tell where they got them.
Richard, R-O-H-R, and our faculty has been reading a book by him called Falling Upwards, and it's a challenging book, because he's saying there ought to be two parts to your life, and the first part is, he says, it's when you make your vessel that does what you do really well. The second part ought to be filling it up. But he says we put way too much emphasis on finding out who you are, and people get stuck in that early part of it, and we never pass to the kind of maturity that says, you know, I've kind of figured this out, what I can do, and developed my skill set, and now you need to spend the second part of your life just doing that and in enjoying doing that and so forth. Well, yeah, I think about that all the time. Yeah, right, yes. There we are, yeah. Show mercy, there you are. Elaine, I'm thinking about your point about just being still and quiet. One of the reasons why I might favor having the form is I am certifiable ADHD, including the H, which you can observe here, and the hyperactivity and so forth. And I think for a hyperactive person, being still and quiet is a very, very great challenge. It's not easy at all. So just to have some kind of, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I do things with my body, and I kneel and I make a sign of the cross and so forth, because for me, it helps me focus and so forth. But I know that the world isn't like me. So.
It sounds a little counterintuitive, but it actually takes more energy to be still.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
I mean, it's really hard for me to clear all that. And but once you practice it, it becomes easier. But I want to use the word intentional. You have to be very intentional about that.
When I was in college, I took a class in relaxation, and it was an intentional clearing your mind, but it didn't have any kind of religious thing to it. So, you know, when I left, I thought, well, this is kind of like meditation, but it's just no religious thing in it. And you know, you thought about each part of your body and relaxing each part of your body, and going all the way back to the beginning.
Now. Yoga helps me because that involves tensing rather than relaxing. Relaxing is when I find the most difficult to focus, you see. So, yeah.
That breath prayer, you know, be still and know that I am.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
That's the B part's the hardest part.
Yeah. It's going to take me a long time to get there. You know what they say about ADHD people is that there's three parts of the brain. This has apparently been very well researched and documented. There are three parts of the brain that keep you on focus, and we're weak in those three parts. So the ADHD drugs, which I've tried, are just crude drugs. That's just like blowing up a hand grenade in your brain. But it does stimulate those three areas in addition to stimulating everything else, is why I don't like it. I mean, if they had finer drugs, it would be better. But they say that those of us who have the H part of it is that we're providing a kind of stimulation that hopefully helps those three parts of the brain. But just relaxing where I'm not stimulating, that's tough for me. That's really, really tough, yeah. You know, there's a book by a Methodist on praying the rosary. And he has in there a photo of John Wesley's rosary. Now, John Wesley had a rosary. I don't think he used it, actually, but he had. Somebody had probably given it to him. But this book is called Three for Sorrow, Four for Joy, something like that. You can find it on Amazon, but it's... Right, yeah. You know, let me recommend a book that's called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World that can't Stop Talking. And it talks about these very famous, And it's talking about people who have made an enormous impact on the world, and when you learn about them, they were actually introverts. And she says that, Susan Cain is the author, C-A-I-N, but she says Americans invented this idea in the early 20th century that the way you change world is you just talk to people and you need to be really close to them. And, you know, I just want to bash people in the head, get you out of my face. But she says it was who wrote the book on how Dale Carnegie introduced this idea of what she calls the extrovert ideal. And that's the real, you know, when people are looking for a candidate to be their next pastor at their church, you know, it's never written quite like this, but they're looking for an extrovert. And she says, her example is Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks, very quiet woman, never wanted to make a fuss about anything. And Rosa Parks is a black woman from Birmingham, and she's sitting, Montgomery, wasn't it? And she's sitting in the first row of the black section of a bus, and the bus driver tells her to move further back so a white person can sit there. And she's just tired after a day's work, and she says one word. No. And you know, she changed the world by... I know. Well, she later moved here, right? And I wish she could say we could say she's United Methodist, but she was AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church.
Well, the center of Grand Rapids is Rosa Parks.
Okay. Well, it's worth naming stuff for her. Oh, yes, Billy Sunday. Oh, yeah. Billy Sunday was just fabulous. I mean, he was a kind of cornball. He was the extrovert ideal, but he was a Chicago White Stockings baseball player, you know, before the White Sox, they were the White Stockings. And he got converted outside of a bar in Chicago and became an evangelist. And he was just a spectacular performer. One of his trademarks was that he would smash a wooden chair during every concert. And these were not worship services. These were just concerts that he had where he would do this spectacular stuff. And he'd say, "When I'm going to fight alcohol all my life. And when I'm old, I'm just going to bite it with my teeth. And when I'm old and don't have any teeth anymore, I'm going to gum it to death." And use all this kind of cornball wisdom. I'm not going to tell you everything, all the things that I, stuff that he said that was kind of on the edge. But yeah, apparently he was here at one time. So yeah, people would come out for these spectacular events that he did. But I'm going to sit down because I'm not Billy Sunday. That's not my... What arcs back and forth?
Well, just all of our, the same thing, I'm a teacher, and the same thing in secondary education, I call it a circle. We just keep going around in a circle, and a circle, and a circle. One of my principals called it an arc, or a pendulum, I guess. But it just, I feel like, you know, you talked about the music and the gospel music, and that's my thing, and I hear about that.
Yeah.
You talk about bringing things together, we thought we'd bring it together, but they're apart. And even the fights that they had in the early, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same.
Yeah, there are a lot of issues that do go back and forth. Now, as a historian, I'm always wanting to say how complicated they are. Use of contemporary worship, of contemporary music is one of the big issues. And it's not just an issue of do you use contemporary music styles. It seems to me that's why not. It's whether you use... whether you agree that you should sing certain songs as a community. So
I need to say this. Officially, some people are going to need to.
Got it. Yeah.
I think he's got lots more to say. Some of you want to hang around. And
yeah.
To hang
sure.
Around.
And I'm supposed to meet Phil some point in the next hour or so.
He's showing up here to get you.
Okay, good. Yeah, fine. He's going to show me an eagle around here. So.
We got three eagles.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you. I have an interesting thing about my particular